Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and it's a good thing because we're going to talk about the early church. We're going to talk about the papacy, and he wrote a book about the early church. He wrote a book about the papacy. So if you've got especially papacy questions today, a papacy that has to do with popes, in case that's a new one for you, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Joe himself is a shameless papist. Shameless Popery is his, what do you call it, podcast, his show,
YouTube
all of that.
Channel,
YouTube channel, it, yes. Yeah. Joe Heschmeyer, welcome.
Thanks, good to be here.
You ready for difficult questions on the papacy?
We'll find out.
All right, I was thinking maybe something more confident was going to come out, but all right, we'll find out.
Pride cometh before the fall.
That's true.
I want to be open to the fact that I could be totally caught off guard.
888-318-7884, the number. If you're Catholic, if you're not Catholic, whatever. If you've got a question about popes from the early ones all the way up till today, 888-318-7884. What's the evidence for the papacy in the early church, Joe? That's where I want to start with you today.
That's a good question. So let's talk about this in layers, because obviously we want to start with Scripture, and you see St. Peter has this special role. And sometimes there are a few different ways Christians will try to explain it. They'll say, you know, Peter's just naturally a leader. And I don't doubt that he has some natural, we'll say, drive. You know, he's quick to give answers to things. But I don't think that adequately explains the biblical evidence, because it's very clear that Jesus puts him in charge of things. Mm-hmm. Like when he tells Peter, "You are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church. The gates of Hades won't prevail against it. And I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And wherever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Peter doesn't claim those things for himself. Jesus gives those to him.
Right, right.
Now, I know people want to debate, what does Jesus mean by upon this rock? For purposes of brevity and simplicity, let's leave that aside and say, whatever he means by that, he is clearly giving the keys of the kingdom to Peter individually and uniquely, and promising Peter the ability to bind on earth and bind in heaven, bind on earth things that will then be bound in heaven, and loose on earth things that will then be loosed in heaven. So you have this clear authority that Peter seems to have in Scripture, and Peter's able to act in a decisive way for the whole church. Maybe the clearest example of this is in Acts chapter 10, where Peter, individually, without consulting anybody else, is led by God to open the doors of salvation to the Gentiles when he goes to the house of Cornelius and begins baptizing Gentiles. This is a first. This isn't just like an ordinary baptism, because prior to this, everyone who'd ever been baptized had been a Jewish convert to Christianity. And so they already had, you know, covenant status in the old covenant. And so people coming from that background could understand what this meant of, okay, this is already part of Israel, and now this is the long-awaited Messiah. It's quite shocking when then people who weren't Jews, who hadn't been waiting for the Messiah, who weren't parties to the Mosaic Covenant, start coming in. And Peter is acting in this unilateral way. He's actually challenged on this in Acts 11, but then explains that basically God told him to do this, and his critics are satisfied, at least for the time. Later, there is a challenge again in Acts 15, and the Council of Jerusalem is called. But even there, it's not a challenge against Peter directly. So nobody seems to be just saying, like, well, Peter's not allowed to do that without consultation, and including the Council of Jerusalem. They don't say, you know, Peter acted wrongly or something like this. Of course, mm-hmm. Very clearly in Acts, Peter has this kind of capacity. The big question becomes, well, does that authority that somebody is left in charge in this way pass on? And if so, does it pass on to the Bishop of Rome or to somebody else? I think one thing to say at the outset is, if that authority passes on to anyone, it's clearly the Bishop of Rome. Like, nobody else is claiming to have that authority. Nobody else is claiming to be above the Pope. Whereas you have popes making these kind of claims, and you have other people making these claims, you know, about the Pope. So, for instance, Pope St. Leo, writing in the 400s, or, well, preaching, this is Sermon 3, it preaches on the feast of Peter and Paul. And he says of St. Peter, "So dearly beloved, with reasonable obedience, we celebrate today's festival by such methods that in my humble person, he, Peter, may be recognized and honored, in whom abides the care of all the shepherds, together with the charge of the sheep commended to him, and whose dignity is not abated even in so unworthy an heir." And he says a bunch of other things kind of similar to that. But the point there is, he's not making some, you know, bold, provocative claim of some, you know, brand new thing. He is very clearly saying that Peter was entrusted with the care of all the shepherds. And this is Luke 22. And I'll get into that in a second. And that this lives on in a unique way in the person of the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. That's the claim. And I think that claim is abundantly proved throughout early church history. So just to get a little more into the biblical evidence there, in Luke 22, when the apostles are debating which of them is the greatest, Jesus gives himself as a model for servant leadership. He then tells the 12 they're called to be servant leaders, sitting on the 12 thrones, judging the tribes of Israel. And then he tells Peter that his task is to strengthen his brethren, meaning the other 11.
Right.
So he's very clearly the care of not only the flock, but the shepherds is given to Peter. In John 21, Jesus entrusts his entire flock to Peter. He tells him, "Feed my sheep, tend my lambs, tend my sheep." So one of the kind of early commentaries on this talks about the difference between the lambs and the sheep being the difference between laity and clergy. Whether you take that view or not, it's still clear that there's one flock of Christ, as Jesus says in John 10, and Jesus has just entrusted the care of that one flock to one man. And he never does anything like that to any of the other apostles. Like, there's no similar passage anywhere. And so I think if we start from that and say, okay, well, the early Christians, certainly early popes seem to claim that they had this Petron authority still. You also have plenty of people who aren't popes who are claiming this. Now, the fact that some of the people making this claim are themselves bishops of Rome and popes, I don't think that's a reason to just dismiss the evidence out of hand. Because if what they're saying is heretical, you'd expect them to get a lot of pushback of you know, other bishops saying, "You don't have that authority. What are you talking about?" You know,
right.
Like, if you came out tomorrow and said, "I'm in charge of Catholic Answers," I imagine somebody would politely take you to the side and say, "That's not true. Donna's in charge of Catholic Answers," or, you know, whatever. But as it is, like, that just doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because this authority is recognized. And we can actually see this in the history of ecumenical councils. There is a purported council, the Second Council of Ephesus, that attempts to enshrine heretical doctrine, and the papal legate contradicts it. Says contradicitor, and then flees the city, goes back to Rome, and the Pope declares it a robber synod and does not recognize it as a valid ecumenical council. And today, it's not recognized as a valid ecumenical council in Eastern Orthodoxy or in Catholicism because the Pope rejected it.
Right, right.
Whereas other things, you know, for example, the Council of Chalcedon isn't accepted by all of the patriarchs, but is still considered a valid council because the Pope does accept it. And so you can find plenty of examples like that. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention one more. And obviously there's much more that could be said. In Against Heresies, Book 3, Chapter 3, St. Irenaeus of Lyon talks about the history of the Bishop of Rome, and he traces every pope from the time of Peter and Paul down to his own day, which was the time of Pope Eleutherius, the 13th pope. And he says the reason that he's tracing the Bishop of Rome and not anybody else is it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. So he says, number one, we have to agree with the Church of Rome. And number two, the reason we have to agree with the Church of Rome isn't just because the Pope is always going to be the smartest guy around, nothing like that, but rather that there is a special authority that he has, that the Church of Rome has a preeminent authority. That, I think, is really sufficient. Like, I understand he doesn't give all the ins and outs of, you know, papal infallibility or anything like this, But if he's right about that, if we always have to agree with the Church of Rome, and that this agreement is not just because we always agree with the decisions it makes or because it always matches our own personal read, but because Rome has a preeminent authority,
mm-hmm.
if that's true, everyone should be Catholic because everything else follows logically. When the Church of Rome tells you X, Y, Z, you should believe X, Y, Z. And if it's wrong, if Christians have been getting the basics of the church wrong this early on, I think we're in trouble because Irenaeus is also the first guy to tell us. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels, and he's an early source for a lot of what we know about the early days of Christianity.
All right, I'm going to open it up to you then. If you've got questions about the papacy at any stage, or any, whether it's a theological question, a historical question, maybe an objection to what Joe just said, maybe you'd like a clarification on what Joe just said. Whether you're Catholic or not, if you've got Pope questions, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from Catholic Chemistry, a dating app for Catholics. Founded by a longtime member of the Catholic Answers team, CatholicChemistry.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
He captivates viewers with thought-provoking political and cultural reporting that resonates with Catholics and people of faith.
The 2026 Faith and Entertainment Index reveals 92% of respondents faith has a role to play in modern entertainment. What should we read into these numbers?
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Shameless Popery is his podcast and YouTube channel, and you should check it out because everybody else on earth is. It's getting really, really popular. Check out Shameless Popery. Or call with your Pope questions right now. I'm going to let people talk with Joe while you dial 888-318-7884. Starting out in New Jersey today, where Krista is listening on Domestic Church Radio. We're awful glad to have you. Krista, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a question about as a lifelong Catholic, where are the boundaries with things that I don't agree with? For instance, like Pope Francis is telling bishops and pastors that they can bless gay couples, which I don't agree with, and I don't know if I'm even allowed to question it or argue it, or also Pope Leo's comments about Senator Dick Durbin and his pro-abortion stance. So I just don't know, like, where am I supposed to just accept everything that they say, or am I allowed to question it, or make it?
You're allowed to question, but I think the approach you should take is one of humility, docility, and very much like the way you would approach a parent. Or, you know, you like having an attitude where you're constantly undermining isn't healthy. Like, imagine, like, institutionally, even here at Catholic Answers, or I don't know if you work in a company or anything like this, but if you have people constantly acting in kind of an insubordinate way and calling everything into question and second guessing everything, it can do a lot of damage institutionally, just on a natural human level. And this is true as well at a spiritual level, when we're talking about the church. Jesus foresaw Abraham Lincoln and said that a house divided against itself cannot stand.
He foresaw Abraham Lincoln. Is that
he
how
did.
That
I
went?
I mean, are you going to tell me he didn't?
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, he certainly did, yes. All right.
I didn't technically say he quoted it. I just said he foresaw him and he also said this. And those two statements, while wildly misleading together, are technically both true.
Yep. That's what we're going for, Joe, technical truths. If you can just technically be true in the things you say.
In all seriousness, though, Jesus says that a house divided against itself can't stand. And so one of the things that I think we see, especially online, is that it's very easy for Catholics to form a kind of circular firing squad and tear one another down. But I don't think the solution to that is just to blindly say, oh, whatever the Pope says and does is always the right thing, because that obliterates the distinction between infallible and non-infallible teaching. So as Catholics, we believe that there are different levels of authority by which the Pope acts. In the same way that federal law and the tweets of the president are not the same thing, like an executive order is an official act in the way a tweet isn't, so likewise, when somebody is interviewing the Pope off the cuff, that doesn't have the same kind of authority. So in terms of the comments Pope Leo made about Dick Durbin, I don't think he was trying to say anything about his pro-choice record. I think he actually is trying not to get into it publicly at that juncture, because he was very much caught off guard and basically said as much in his comments. And, you know, then he talked about the death penalty and things. And I understand that, you know, people read that as a false equation. I don't think you have to read it that way. So I would say this. Number one, you don't have to just treat every off-the-cuff comment as if it's infallible church teaching. Number two, you don't even have to treat fallible church teachings or decisions or disciplines as if they're infallible statements of faith and morals. So in the example of Fiducia Supplicans, where the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith permitted spontaneous blessings to be given by two same-sex couples, that you can say that's wildly imprudent and likely to lead to a lot of confusion about the church's sexual teaching and push back against it. And in fact, that is politely what the bishops in Africa did. And the church was like, yeah, that's fine. Like, you can do that. They weren't, you know, denounced as being insubordinate or anything like this. They said, like, that's not going to fly. It's going to be confusing. That's not helpful. Because the reality is, you can believe both. When two people present themselves for a blessing, you can bless them without knowing all of their particulars. That's true. And people have been doing that with people they didn't know were involved in immoral sexual relations for time immemorial, because you don't know all the ins and outs of people receiving a blessing. That's true, but also trying to, you know, institutionalize that in any kind of official way is potentially scandalous and misleading. So I think you can judge, well, I know you can judge inaction as imprudent. You don't have to just blindly say whatever the church or a dicastery within the church does is automatically the best thing to do. That is not the duty you owe to the church as a Catholic, and the church does not ask that of you. But you should be ready to submit your intellect and will to the teaching of the church. And a good word for this is you should be docile to the church as mother and teacher. And so if you take that approach of listening, trying to understand, not starting off from a posture of cynicism, skepticism, or rebellion, but rather saying, what can I learn from the church? And then trying to understand that as best you can in light of everything else you've learned from the church. That's the path forward.
What do you think about that, Krista?
Okay. No, I agree with all that. I just wasn't sure if I had any right as a Catholic to question anything the Pope says or does. Am I just supposed to accept everything, or am I supposed to use my common sense and my good judgment to say, you know, that doesn't sound right? And, like, yeah, you know, the blessing of the gay couples, to me, that seems like it just causes scandal more than anything else.
And yeah, I think
you're having a hard time with that one.
Perfectly allowed to do that. Again, the fact that there were cardinals and bishops in the church who pushed back and said, you know, even if this is technically true, it's very misleading, confusing, and scandalous. And that response was treated seemingly pretty favorably. I mean, it didn't seem like the Pope or the Vatican said, like, how dare you question that? There was nothing like that. We don't want to try to treat everything as if it's infallible church teaching, because that's actually confusing and unhelpful.
But let me just ask you this, if I may. Krista, I'll just add this question to yours, and you can tell me if it's dumb and it doesn't fit. But is there, Joe, in all that you've said, do we have to make a distinction between what we do publicly and what we might do privately?
Yes. And this is something the church talks about. I'm glad you mentioned this. Donum Veritatis, I believe, talks about this as well, where there is a sense of... here we go. Donum Veritatis 27. Even if the doctrine of the faith is not in question, the theologian will not present his own opinions or divergent hypotheses as though they were non-arguable conclusions. Respect for the truth, as well as for the people of God, requires this discretion. For the same reason, the theologian will refrain from giving untimely public expression to them. So even on areas where there's a legitimate diversity of opinion, we should be very careful about how we speak and act on these questions, because one of the perennial dangers is that we want to present our opinion on a disputed issue as if it's like the Catholic opinion. And Donum Veritatis 27 is saying, don't do that. It goes on to talk about cases where an individual disagrees, even with the fallible magisterium, and that you should avoid turning to the mass media to try to exert the pressure of public opinion. So you don't try to do like a pressure campaign to be like, can you believe the church did this? And try to organize, you know, a bunch of pushback, because again, that undermines people's trust in their bishops and in their pope. That's not helpful. Like, even if you win the battle, you lose the war, because people just trust the church less, and that causes a lot of damage. So those words are written, you know, particularly for theologians, but I think they're a good model for all of us.
All right, Chris, I jumped on your question. Was that all right? Or
no, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Let's send, if she said no, if she was mad at me, I was not going to send her a book. But since she said that was okay, let's send her Pope Peter, Joe's book, Pope Peter, about... the papacy, one of Joe's favorite topics. All you have to do, hang on, Chris, to give us an address there in New Jersey, and we will send it off. The number here is 888-318-7884. Jack is in Michigan listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Glad to have you, Jack. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, by the way, we have a mutual friend, Father Laurent.
Father Laurent Okatashi? Joe.
Joe knows lots of Father Laurents, so he needs to know which one. he's going through his mental Rolodex. Like, how many Father Laurents do I know? So,
I know which one you mean.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah. So anyway, my question is on the gates of Hades, and What exactly are the gates of Hades? And I'm wondering if they could mean protection against lies, because Christ said that Satan is the father of lies. And so I'm wondering if those are connected and what exactly the gates are.
A metonym or a synecdoche. I never pronounce the word synecdoche right, but I think I'm getting it right there. That's what Gates of Hades is.
Close enough for me. Me too, man. I'm not going to argue with you about it. Go ahead.
So in Genesis 22, I believe it is. Let me double check that. Yeah. Genesis 22:17, one of the promises God gives to Abraham is this: I will indeed bless you, and I'll multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. Now, that does not mean they're just like stealing the gates from other places and getting a big collection of gates somewhere. It's not that. That rather, when we talk about the gates of the city, it's like when you refer to a car as a, you know, oh, it's a nice set of wheels you got. You mean the entire car, and you're referring to the whole by one part. So gates of Hades means Hades. Gates of the city means the city. And so you can find other places as well. I believe it's Isaiah 14, where it says, wail, O gate, cry out, O city. And it's using gate and city interchangeably. That's what's happening there. So Hades and gates of Hades are the same. So anything where... the forces of Hades would triumph over the church, that would be the gates of Hades prevailing.
So could one of those forces be a lie?
Well, I think it depends what you mean. Yes, if a lie triumphed over the church, then yes. We want to be clear there that there's a distinction. We're not saying that when Jesus says in Matthew 16, the gates of Hades shall not prevail, that this means Catholics will never tell a lie. It doesn't even mean that Catholics won't, you know, individually go to hell or something like that. But the church won't be destroyed by the forces of Hades.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was thinking a lie being taught as truth. Yeah, so... Okay.
Do you see? I wonder if you know if you're getting what he means, Joe. That like it's saying the gates of Hades won't prevail, meaning that the church is not going to teach something that's false. It's not going to teach a lie.
Oh yeah, I see. So if the church taught a lie, then I think it would be true to say the gates of Hades prevail because falsehood would prevail over truth. So if the church, like if in order to be a Catholic, I had to believe something damnable and heretical, then it would be contrary to the church being the church, because the church is the way. Jesus describes himself as the way, the truth, and the life. The church then describes herself as the way in Acts, even before she's known as the Catholic Church. She's got this very grand title of the way. Well, the church can't be the way and be teaching heresy and be teaching, you know, damnable falsehood. So in that situation, the gates of Hades would prevail over the church if that were to happen. And so we're promised that'll never happen.
I'll tell you what, if you'd like a copy of one of Joe's books, hang on the line, Jack, and we'll get an address and we'll send you a copy of whichever of Joe's books you want. Hey, we're talking about the papacy today. All the lines are full. One will be open shortly, 888-318-7884. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What is the Catholic Church? Everybody seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people try to make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern
on the next Beacon of Truth, how to cherish friendships in Soulful Psalm 138.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. What's happening over there on your podcast, Shameless Popery?
So Joe. I recently responded to a woman who claimed the Catholic Church, all of the distinctive practices were taken from paganism, and particularly Babylonian paganism.
Oh, really? Was she an expert on ancient Babylonian paganism?
As much of one as you would expect.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, it was... I got to go through and show the actual sources compared to what she was claiming, and I think the truth wins out in a situation like that.
Are you in a situation like that? Are you tempted to say something like, "This would be a really good theory for the 19th century"?
Yes, actually, because she is basing this off of Alexander Hislop, writing in the 19th century. That's right.
Yeah.
And the thing with Hislop is, at the time he was writing, he's doing a Christian version of an atheist argument or an anti-Christian argument. You know, Trent's book, When Protestants Argue Like Atheists.
Yeah.
So there had been this wave of, this is called pan-Babylonism. And if you haven't heard of that, there's going to be a good reason for that. There was this idea that all of the distinctive elements of Christianity were actually taken from ancient Babylonian religion. And so even like the story of Jesus and all of this was really just Babylonian religion. And this was true not only of Christianity, but in some versions, this is true of like all of the world religions.
Oh.
And this is just nonsensical. And now, obviously, a Protestant like Alexander Hislop isn't going to endorse that because he's Presbyterian. But he's going to say, oh, no, like Protestantism's true.
But all this the Catholic stuff. Yeah,
yeah, like
right.
Lent, that comes from 40-day penitential practices in ancient Babylon, which don't exist. But, right. You know, it's a dumb version of an already dumb theory, to put it bluntly. But at the time, it's at the edge of respectability in the sense that people don't know very much about ancient Babylon.
Right.
And so you can make all kinds of crazy guesses. And then they discovered, like, the Assyrian language, which they didn't really know about before. And actually, one of the greatest kind of details in this is a Jesuit priest was the leading expert on ancient, like, Babylonian stuff in the, like, at the turn of the 20th century. Father Francis Xavier Kugler, a Jesuit, German Jesuit. He was also, like, a chemist. He's a brilliant guy. But he was able to definitively prove that this whole theory doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And for Babylon to have given rise to all of these world religions, it would have had to have been like many thousands of years older than it actually is. And we can actually trace the rise of Babylonian religious practices. So we know they're not old enough. Like it's younger than Judaism. So like right. It just couldn't be the source of Judaism. In Hislop's view, like it was the source even of like indigenous religions in the New World. Like he claimed Mexicans had a day on their calendar dedicated to Odin before Columbus got there. And it's like, none of that is real. Like none of that is true at all. And so it hasn't held up very well.
Yeah, but man, once this theory gets going,
you'll still hear people be like, oh yeah, this is Nimrod, this is Tammuz, and it's like, no,
right.
First of all, Nimrod wasn't married to a woman named Semiramis, and they didn't have a kid together. Like, the basic trinity that is at the heart of Hislop's book doesn't exist. Like, everything about this is wrong, or it's based on like the flimsiest of similarities. Like, look, here is this goddess holding a baby, and here's another picture of a goddess holding a baby. And it's like, yeah
people have babies.
Like a million pictures of women holding
this
babies.
This is literally one of the most common images in human
exactly.
history. Yeah.
It's all right. Like when people say like, oh, they had candles in this religion. It's like, yeah, they needed light.
Yeah, right. Like candles? That sounds very Catholic. all right. Check it out at Shameless Popery. You can get it at wherever you get your podcasts. You can get it over on Joe's YouTube channel, Shameless Popery. It's not too hard to find. Back to the phones we go. We're talking about the papacy this hour. Sebastian is in Massachusetts watching on YouTube. Welcome, Sebastian. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm actually calling on behalf of my Protestant friend who is actually pretty in line with certain Catholic doctrines.
Okay.
But he says that his greatest hurdle against converting to Catholicism is getting over the history of the Catholic Church and the papacy when it comes to, you know, attempting to cover up certain issues and scandals in the church and its
sure.
clergy. Now, my pretty novice apologetic response to this was, you know, the fact that every church, including the true Catholic Church, does have fallible men in it. But it shouldn't deter us from Christ and his one true church. He doesn't really.
That was your
that.
Novice try?
I mean, yeah.
That was
studying apologetics.
Pretty good. Pretty good start.
I didn't accept that answer, so I was hoping to get a good response, a better response
well,
from you guys.
What did he say when you said that?
He kind of said how he didn't really agree with the fact that they still tried their best to cover it up and almost sweep it under the rug and not address it. Does that make sense?
You want to just say, like, yeah, me neither.
Well, I kind of responded with, you know, I'm sure there's certain Protestant denominations and things happening in their churches where, you know, they've also covered
well,
up.
Well, no, I just mean this. I think your impulse was a good one, that we don't want to judge the truth claims of Christianity based on bad Christians. We don't want to judge the particular truth claims of Catholicism based on bad Catholics, including bad leaders in the church. It would be an unreasonable standard, because that's not something we like. If our claim was, if you become Catholic, our leaders never sin or err or anything like that, then those would be great disproofs. But we don't claim that. In fact, if you read the scriptures, it's very clear, like the people Jesus calls as apostles, or the people that are called out throughout the Old Testament by God, they have pretty serious moral failings. And, you know, David can be a man after the heart of God and also a murderer. You know, like those two things can both be true. And when you think about it in kind of that biblical framework, you wouldn't reject Israel because of the moral decrepitude of the leaders of Israel, I would hope, or of the priests of Israel, I would hope, because it's very clear from Scripture itself that frequently there are grave sins done on the part of Israel's leaders, both their civil leaders and the religious leaders. And this is also true in the New Testament. I mean, the first pope denied Jesus three times. Judas is one of the apostles, and he was sent out to baptize, and he had divine authority to act and preach. Those things are all true just from Scripture itself. So when you read it in that light, the fact that God continues to allow men to become pope who are manifestly unworthy, or even in the best of cases, are sinners in need of redemption, fits, I think, the overall schema. You don't have to say everything the pope does is okay or good. So I think you can say that, you know, God calls sinners to positions of leadership, and if there weren't sinners in the church, it wouldn't be a very big church. But also, you can call out sin when it happens. So one of the dangers is if we push back too much, it looks like you're minimizing, downplaying, or legitimizing things that shouldn't be minimized, downplayed, or legitimated. So you can just say, like, yes, that was a bad thing, and it should not have happened. Full stop. You know, if you want to compare it to other, you know, Protestant denominations or public schools, there's pretty decent evidence that both of them have had worse abuse scandals. If your friend thinks the Catholic Church is the only one to deal with a scandal like this, or the only one to engage in a widespread pattern of institutional self-protection and cover-up, then you can share those details as you see appropriate. I don't actually think that you need to do that, though. I think it's fine to just hold two beliefs simultaneously. One, horrible things were done by church leaders, both the original crimes and then the cover-up. And two, we remain Catholic in spite of wicked men who deserve millstones, because we follow Christ, not Judas.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I'm going to definitely go back and watch this as I usually do, and definitely come back with these points to him again. Hopefully we'll have a more fruitful conversation after this. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. So like I said, just be careful, because if you do the contextualizing, it can look like downplaying. So just watch out for that, and then just say, yeah, shouldn't have happened. That's not why I'm Catholic.
Yeah.
And hopefully you can be Catholic in spite of the bad actions of Catholics. And then, you know what? So obviously feel free to call back, but feel free to have him call back as well. If he's got a question and wants to talk about it, you know, let him hear this personal invitation to give us a call.
Yeah,
we love
definitely.
Hearing from people who aren't Catholic, who are maybe on the fence about things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Sebastian. That took us to the break. Right back with more questions about the papacy for Joe Heschmeyer, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The Adoration Sodality of the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration at the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, Alabama, is a prayer group for laity, priests, and religious brothers and sisters to spiritually join in the nun's mission of adoring our Lord Jesus Christ in the Holy Eucharist. Members commit themselves to an hour of Eucharistic adoration on a monthly, weekly, or daily basis at a monstrance or tabernacle at the parish of their choice. Learn more about becoming a member at iadorethee.com.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest today on Catholic Answers Live, both hours devoted to the papacy, and a lot of people have Pope questions. Right now, some lines have loosened up. We got three open for you. If you have a Pope question, whether it's challenging or curious or whatever, wherever it's coming from, whether you are Catholic or not a Catholic, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We're happy to talk about the Pope, and whatever angle you bring to it, you'll be helping us do that. 888-318-7884. Avery is in Princeton, Texas, watching on YouTube. Avery, welcome. You got a question for Joe?
Yes, sir.
All right.
I do have a question. I had a question about like intellectual assent, but that actually already got answered. So.
Oh. All right. We'll call back another day. Thanks, Avery. Bye.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
No, I'm just teasing.
I do have another early church /. I guess papacy question. I'm an Anglican. I grew up like IHOP adjacent. I'm assuming Kansas City. You know.
You mean International House of Prayer, not like you live near a Denny's.
No, that's correct. Yeah, I do like pancakes, but no, it was the heresies and all that.
Fair enough. Yep.
Yeah. So recently became an Anglican in the past couple years. Got out of all that, but I am very conflicted about some of these statements on how I'm trying to find a way to word this. I agree. The way that I look at it is that if the magisterium exists, it doesn't necessarily matter if the papacy, as it sits now or as of like Vatican I. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's always been that way, because if the magisterium says something is true, then it's true. But I guess I'm conflicted on the doctrinal development of the papacy in the early church.
Okay. Anything particular about the doctrinal development of the papacy? I can answer it kind of broadly, but if I can go more specific if you'd
sure,
like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the most... The thing that kind of, I guess, I struggle with the most is that I've seen some writing somewhere, and you probably know, that effectively state that the Pope has always been the Pope, and that he's always been the Pope the way that he is the Pope. Is that in Vatican I or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way people often kind of summarize Vatican I. But I mean, the Pope has always been
okay.
The Pope. The way his office has kind of played out varies not just from age to age, but honestly from pope to pope.
I guess I don't see how in the early church, I've gone through like Irenaeus, Ignatius, and stuff like that, but I don't see it in the same level that it's portrayed in like Vatican I.
Yeah, I mean, if by that you mean like the Pope doesn't normally throw his weight around, I think that's largely true. St. John Henry Newman, talks about how one of the difficulties with authority is that you often see it when there's a conflict. Like when people are getting along, I mean, in Catholic Answers right now, as far as I know, we don't have any kind of internal crisis. And if we do... I'm not aware of it.
And not so as long as Donna's in charge.
Exactly. When everybody's just getting along, the question of who is running things is really secondary. Like in a marriage, if you're having to constantly be like, I'm the man, that's a sign something is not going right in your marriage. Even if you're like, I'm your parents, I said so, hopefully you're not leaning on that too much. And so it makes sense if you follow the Christian understanding of what leadership is, as Jesus lays it out in Luke 22, where it's service for the flock. We see the Pope from the earliest days serving the flock. And you see this in a lot of ways. And as it's quicker to reach distant parts of the empire. You see it happening more and more. But even in the year 96, you've got Pope St. Clement writing First Clement, and he's apologizing that it's taken him a while to write the letter because they were under persecution. And he's writing to resolve an internal controversy in the church in Corinth. I don't know of a good example like that of anybody else who's not like a friendly bishop everybody just knows. Meaning, like when Ignatius is on his way to his martyrdom, he will write encouraging letters to the Christians of churches that he knows who've just taken care of him on his way. The same way that you might write a letter to, you know, family that you're friends with and say, like, kids, remember, you're not like intervening in the internal affairs of the family. You're just writing a friendly letter to people you're friends with. So you have things like that. But for a stranger who doesn't know them individually, personally, to not only step into an internal dispute within a local church, but actually be invited into that dispute by the members of a church founded by St. Paul, which is what you have in Corinth, while the Apostle John is still alive, and they're writing to St. Peter, his successor, I should say, Clement. That, like, I don't know, it just seems like that kind of thing looks papal to me. I understand you can maybe read some of these things in a different way. So there's another thing I'd say as well, but I think all of that is perfectly harmonious with, at the very least, perfectly harmonious with what Vatican I says about the papacy. Does that strike you as not the case?
No, actually, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't heard it put that way before, where effectively, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of stating that it hadn't been stated in that way explicitly because there wasn't the need to do so.
Right. I mean, you find more statements about the exact way authority shakes out when those things are needed, when that kind of comes up. And unless and until the rubber hits the road in that way, you don't need to know. You know, again, like at a company, hopefully you don't need to ever figure out exactly which people at the company can fire you because you're not in a situation where that's like a relevant concern. I don't know here exactly who I know some people who can. There's maybe more than I know. I hope to never find out. And I'm totally content with that, not in a kind of insubordinate way, but like when everything's going well, the need for leaning on that authority is a lot less. And so even in history, even if you go much later, some of the strongest popes don't talk about their authority all that much. Or when they do, it's more in a kind of theological musing, the way, you know, Pope St. Leo does, rather than like a respect my authority kind of pushback against people. Like even there's the Bull of Unum Sanctum, which is a very famous declaration of papal authority. And it's all true. But an important thing in reading it is to know that Boniface is having trouble with the French crown and that the response of the King of France is to send some goons to beat the Pope up. Like it is exactly when things are kind of breaking down at a level where the French king thinks it's okay to get a Pope beaten and eventually he dies from his injuries. When things are going well, nobody's trying to beat the Pope to death and the Pope's not having to write letters like the Bull of Unum Sanctum. It's when you have that breakdown that you have to stress the nature of authority much more.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense.
All right.
Great.
Thank you very much for the call. On we must go because lines continue full. Again, are you, questions about the papacy today? You're welcome to call with your papal questions. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe, who do you want to go to next? Just tell me a number, a line number, because I am a little confused at the moment.
Let's go with number 5.
That's where I was going to go. Ben in Chicago, Illinois, listening on the Catholic Answers app. I just didn't have the confidence to do it, Joe.
He'd been waiting the longest.
All right, Ben, go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for taking my call. And real quick, Joe, I just want to thank you for the apologetic work you do. You're one of the main reasons I'm considering Catholicism right now. I'm coming from an evangelical background, so just want to encourage you, keep doing what you're doing. You're doing an amazing job.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. So my question is in regards to the church's infallibility. So As I understand it, there is no infallible list of infallible teachings which has been published or shared by the church anywhere. And so, at least from where I'm sitting, it seems that ordinary Catholics have no way to infallibly know which papal statements or teachings from ecumenical councils, et cetera, are like truly infallible. And maybe there's a wider, broader category of things that we could talk about. But from what I see, like, there are Catholic theologians that are constantly arguing about what is and is not infallible teaching, with different people kind of interpreting some contradictory teachings in different ways. So my question is, how is this fundamentally any different from the problem Protestants face within a Sola Scriptura framework? Because it would seem that the problem of interpretation is equally present in, you know, in both traditions, even though the subject of what's being interpreted is different.
This is half true, and I think that's a good way of trying to think about it. That in both cases, there is a need for personal interpretation in the sense that you have to, like, your mind has to act, like, no matter how clear something is objectively, you still have to subjectively read and understand it. And so, you know, that's true of scripture, that's true of papal statements, that's true of a math book, that's true of just literally anything. There is a subjective act of cognition and understanding. And when we're talking about theological truth, there's also the subjective act of faith. There's faith is used in two ways in the Bible. There is subjective faith, the faith by which we believe, and that can go up or down. You can talk about someone having little faith, you know, Peter walking on water, or you can talk about great faith, you know, the Syrophoenician woman, whatever. It can go up or down. It's subjective. There's different amounts. But there's also the faith in which we believe. That's called the objective faith. That's the faith delivered once for all to the saints, Jude 1:3. So we use the gift of faith to believe in the faith. So the subjective fact of, like, you have to assent remains the same. The difference is the contours of the contents of the objective faith are much clearer in Catholicism. Because let me give an example that might illustrate this. Imagine two countries. One of them has a constitution and a set of laws, but it doesn't have a court system. Everyone has to just read the constitution and read the laws and figure out what they think it means. And if they have a dispute, they can talk about it with other people. The other has a constitution, a set of laws, but also a court that can tell you what the constitution and the laws mean. And this court, in this example, is guided by the Holy Spirit. Now, in both of those cases, you're going to find disputes. In both of those cases, people are going to disagree about what does this law mean? What did the Constitution mean? In country two, they might even disagree about what did the court mean when it said this? So dispute doesn't automatically go away. But the difference between these two countries is that in case number one, the disputes are interminable and irresolvable. You know, in that imaginary country, it would be completely unworkable. They're obviously going to have secession and rebellion and everything else because they're never going to all just agree on the meaning of the laws. And in country two, even though disputes will arise, they can be resolved. So in the history of the Catholic Church, you find disputes and heresies and conflicts and everything that arise, and you find the church settling those things, sometimes right away, sometimes over time. In the history of Protestantism, you find these major schisms and heresies and errors and divisions that arise, and they never go away. Like, the number of Protestant denominations never goes down. It only goes up. It doesn't have a mechanism to resolve conflict when it arises. There's no means of producing unity. The Catholic Church has a means of producing unity, which doesn't mean we're always totally united on everything, but it means that when conflict arises, the church can point us in the direction of unity. We then still have to assent to that. We could just rebel. We could be bad Catholics. But even the idea of being a bad Catholic assumes there's something I can reject that is a clear standard. Within the world of Protestantism, I don't know exactly how one could even be a bad Protestant. It's just a different Protestant. Mm. Like Lutherans and Methodists, it's not like Methodists are bad Lutherans or Lutherans are bad Methodists. They're just different things. They're using the same principles and coming to different conclusions. So I don't know. Does that distinction make sense? Like, you're right that there is a subjective dimension, and you're right that it can lead to confusion. But is it clear that there is a difference in how that's resolved?
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess my main the only thing I'm left wondering is, if I'm a Catholic, how do I infallibly know which teachings to follow?
I'll answer that after this break. How about that?
Okay.
Ben, you got to hang on for a little bit. We've got one line open. If you're on the line, hang on the line. If you haven't called yet, give us a call, 888-318-7884, if you have questions about the papacy, about the popes, about its history, about its theology, whatever, about it in the scripture. You're welcome. 888-318-7884.